You found the Diggin' Oak Island podcast, the podcaster's journey to discover the truth behind the Oak Island mystery. I'm Dave McBride. Thank you guys so much for downloading and listening. If you have been listening to and enjoying our little podcast, please consider helping us out by becoming a patron. Go to patreon.com/diggin' oak island to learn more. Again, folks, if you think this podcast is worth $5 a month to you and you would like to see us keep going strong, please consider helping us out by becoming a patron. You can go to patreon.com/diggin' oak island to sign up. Patrons get exclusive access to a live chat during the U.S. broadcast of each new episode of The Curse of Oak Island. Listen, come and join us for this chat. It is so much fun. And I want to welcome a new patron this week. Annette, thank you, Annette, so much for your support. It really means everything to us, my friend. Thank you so much. Welcome to the family. Come join us for the live chats. Again, folks, patreon.com/diggin' oak island. Sign up, support the podcast, only $5 a month, and you can cancel anytime. Now, if you don't like to do the monthly thing, but you want to help out the show with a donation, you could do so via Venmo. Just use the username at Dave McBride Music. That's what I use for my musician job here. And so it's always the easiest way to do it. And the only place I have really set up to even handle such a thing. I don't have anything for the podcast. So that's the best I can offer. If you want to do it, feel free. It's totally up to you. At Dave McBride Music on Venmo. All right. We want to start off the podcast with emails from you guys. Now, I have only a few this week, about as many as we usually have, but a few of them are pretty long. But I want to get started instead with an email plug from a listener named Jeff, who writes, "Hey, Dave, I've been listening for about 4 years now and will be becoming a patron very soon. I just got laid off, so I decided to make my own new channel and podcast on debunking the production behind shows like Oak Island, discussing episodes and reviewing seasons on all types of paranormal shows. We don't try to actually debunk the paranormal, as too many people already do that. Because Oak Island is one of my favorite shows, I've started with it. I hope you enjoy it if you have the time to watch it, Jeff." Folks, the show is on YouTube. It's called Expedition BS. Now, there's a curse or two in the beginning when he's explaining what Expedition BS stands for. I'm sure you can probably work that out yourself, but just earmuff the kids if you turn it on. But it's really good stuff, Jeff. I really like it. Folks, head over there. It's on YouTube, Expedition BS. Like and subscribe. Do all that stuff. Let's support our friend here. Again, the like button means everything, apparently, to YouTube, and the subscribe as well. So that's the best way to support him. Jeff, we'll be watching for sure. Now, let's go to a long email from an old friend of ours, Bill, who writes, "Hey, Dave. About that crackpot session Doug Kroll ran at the end of last night's episode," and he means last week, not this week. "It's centered around symbols, and as you know, and you know what that means. Another bucket of cold water from your pal Bill in Wisconsin. So I'm all for agreeing that the copper decorative object is freaking amazing, and I'd love to know what it is. What I can tell you, though, is that it's not linked to any of the groups Doug claimed it is, at least not in the way he said. Here's why. First, the show implied it was perhaps Viking, using an Icelandic document of some sort, and pointing to these two symbols that might be on the copper object appearing together in a quadrant of the document. The problem is the symbols on the document are not Viking symbols, as Doug says at one point, but bog standard astrological symbols. The only Viking ruin that looks like the symbol they show us is Othala, which is one that you see there. It's the letter O. And it's always written angularly enough that I think we can discount it as round horned symbol on the copper object. It's more of a diamond with legs. So to rule out the Icelandic chart having much to do with this, what the chart shows from the first quadrant on is a zodiac sign and a planet in the old sense of the word, which included the sun, the moon, and any other big heavenly body. It reads as basically the signs of the zodiac and perhaps planets that were considered dominant in those seasons in some year or in general. Now, let me stop here. Bill includes in this email some visual representations of this stuff, some video. I'm sorry, not video, some images of this stuff and the specific symbols and the translations. It's hard really for me to read them to you, so it's a little difficult here. So I'm going to put them on the Facebook. You guys can get a look. Just go to facebook.com, put in at Diggin' Oak Island, and you'll be able to get there. He explains it pretty well, though. So let me continue here. He writes, the planets are listed in regularly repeating cycle. You'll notice that the Mars, Sun, Venus, Mercury, Moon sequence repeats. Possibly the next year would have started with Saturn in Aries. Hard to know without astronomical or astrological knowledge that I don't have. But it's absolutely not a specifically Viking thing. Nor is this exactly obscure knowledge. You'll notice I was able to produce all of the symbols right out of the Unicode character set that's on every computer in the world, with those definitions right there in Unicode as well. This should also clear up what these internationally recognized symbols would be doing on an astrolabe. The hypothesis floated that this might have been something decorative on an astrolabe can be discounted immediately. Astrolabes were built for precision and were, at least initially, some of the most expensive and high-tech devices you could get. You would not put a decorative copper cladding on it, as it would negatively affect the accuracy of your readings. You can actually see the words for the zodiac sign Capricornus on the first astrolabe they show. So their appearing in some sequence or other on another astrolabe is not exactly shocking. So what we can come away with, well, maybe those signs could read as Taurus and Sun, though if the show really wanted to show that, I'm not sure why they didn't flip the graphic 180 degrees to make it jibe. But there are plenty of choices you could go with. It could be ancient Egyptian. I don't think it means anything, but you could have either of the following character combinations. And he puts a couple of combinations in there that look a little bit like what you see here. And he says that I don't think either of those make any sense in Egyptian, but my detailed Egyptian references are all in storage at the moment. Yeah, my too, Bill. I don't have them at my fingertips here. And of course, it could just be decorative motif. Don't tell the show's writers I said so, but they missed a big fat softball in that in alchemy, the sun symbol is also the sign for, dum-dum-dum, gold. The other planet signs are Mercury, which sign for Mercury, Venus, which is for copper, Moon for silver, Mars for iron, Jupiter for tin, and Saturn for lead. We didn't know about planets past Saturn until modern telescopes were invented. I very much doubt this has anything to do with alchemy, though. The Taurus symbol could mean congelation, or as we would say today, crystallization. It could also mean bismuth. I'll leave it to the chemists and the alchemists out there to propound a theory making sense of those. Anyway, I thought the show did a weak job of trying to explain the symbols in terms of their favored theories. They might be meaningless, but I think we can move Vikings and late Templar period astrolabes back into the mass of possible guesses. Best as always, Bill. I have to say this again, folks. I am forever stunned by the collective intellect of the listeners to this show. My goodness, Bill, you did your research here and pretty much disproved that entire scene that we saw. I don't think I did a great job there of relaying to you guys the impact of what he wrote. Hopefully putting the images on Facebook will immediately help you, so go check that out. My favorite part of all this is, like Bill said, he actually found these symbols on a computer. I found them on my iPhone in the emoji section. And no one on the show noticed this before going on there to declare them some sort of unknown Viking rune script or whatever they called it. I don't remember what they called it. Unbelievable stuff, Bill. I don't have much to add. I mean, I think you kind of nailed exactly it here. We've got, you just killed it. I mean, we got many more plausible explanations than anything relating the Templars to the Vikings with this piece. But I agree with you. The copper piece is cool, and I want to find out what it is. All right, let's head north of the border and go and hear from Nina and Ab, who write, "Hi, Dave. We are listeners from Vancouver, British Columbia, and enjoy both watching Oak Island and listening to your podcast. The more Oak Island, the better, in our opinion. Thank you so much. We are a week behind on show airings in Canada and delay listening to your podcast to avoid spoilers. So apologies if these comments have already been asked and answered. So since finding the wood at the bottom of the garden shaft, the Oak Island team seemed to be perplexed by the fact that they found only the one set of horizontal logs with no uprights or corresponding horizontal beams. It just struck us that this seems so much like exactly what they should have been hoping to find if they were near the money pit. The repeating log platform every 10 feet. Not sure what the dimensions of those platforms were meant to have been, but what they pulled up seems so much like what we imagine the Oak Island platforms to be, the money pit platforms to be like. How likely do you think that this is another platform, same as the money pit, or another platform in the original pit itself? Could they have found it once and for all? Also, very important bonus question, what does it mean that Alex Lagina looks exactly like William Phipps? Would like to suggest DNA testing to the investigation team. Anywho, thanks so much for the show, Nina and Oba. All right, guys, two great questions. We did answer the first one last week, I think, but it's certainly one that merits discussing again for sure. Could this be the platforms from the money pit? Sure, why not? I mean, that part of the original money pit story is one of the hardest to kind of wrap your mind around when you think about it, right? What was the point of platforms? I mean, sit down and think about it for a second. It doesn't really have any practical application to what they were trying to achieve if you believe the whole money pit idea. The platforms would need to be placed after depositing whatever has been deposited. So did they place these platforms on their way back up the shaft as they were filling it in? And if so, why would they do that? The problem here is that we don't really know what is below this level of wood yet. And it doesn't look like we're going to find out anytime soon. It's an interesting question, but we don't have enough right now really to go either way to say whether or not we think this is money pit related. But, you know, that it is what it is. Now, as far as Alex being a secret relative of William Phipps, you know, Phipps was raised in mid-coast Maine, and in my mind, that's the most beautiful place on the planet. So as far as I'm concerned, would his family really leave there to move to the upper peninsula of Michigan? It's a question worth asking yourself, right? Great stuff. Keep those emails coming. Late or not, we want to hear from Canada. All right, let's go now to our old friend Steve, who wrote two emails this week. The first one is a reference to the silver object last week. And he says, quote, looks like it may be a sword tip cover. Credit to others online who observed the similarity. He added a couple of photos to compare it to. I'll put them on Facebook for you guys as well. I have to say, I think you might have nailed it here, Steve. It certainly does look that way. It's surprising, though, if that's what it is, that nobody in that room would have been able to identify that. Anyway, good work. Also, Steve wrote another email. Great one. He wrote, Dave, this one's been bugging me all day after listening to the most recent podcast, which was great, by the way. Thank you, sir. The argument seems to be something like this. The Templars were rich. The Templars were persecuted, tortured, and killed. Those who were lucky fled. Those who fled took their treasures to hide and protect them. And yet nothing has been found 700 years later. This seems to me to be a, quote, problem looking for a solution. Number one and two are true, so number three must be true. So to this, I offer a loose modern equivalent. The Curse of Oak Island patron, the History Channel, runs a program right after the show called The Lost U-Boats of World War II. The premise that Germany smuggled treasures out of Germany on converted U-boats as the war ended, intending to get them to South America. Some basic facts. Number one. During World War II, Germany plundered billions of dollars in art, artifacts, and valuables. The estimated value of theft from Poland alone is something like $20 billion in 2024 dollars. Number two, as of today, there are still billions of dollars of valuables missing. I believe the metric I saw was as many as 30,000 individual works of art are still missing. The loss of these treasures was just 80 years ago, and yet still missing. When exploring what might have become all of this, the hypothesis include, and it may be a combination of these, one, they were acquired and hidden away by the Allied countries if they were found. Two, liquid valuables like gold bars, or coins, jewels, etc. were possibly stored away and ended up in the federal banks of those Allied countries. Three, at least some of them were destroyed during bombings and other military activities. And four, and or they really did end up in South America with fleeing war criminals. This is the modern era. Does it stand to reason that the same thing happened with the Templars? Translating, maybe the French, the Pope, and other leaders just grabbed as much as they could. It ended up in their coffers. Or some of them may have simply been destroyed during the Purge. finally, and perhaps they were spirited away. But closer locations like Portugal and Scotland, where they may remain today. Hope that all makes sense. As Occam's razors taught us, sometimes the simplest answer is the right one. Have a great weekend, Easter weekend, Steve. Steve, you hope you had a great holiday too. As we talked about last week, there is one thing we know for sure in all this, right? The Templars were rich, perhaps the richest organization in all of Europe at the height of their power. However, their fall was not immediate. It didn't just happen overnight. The French king didn't just get up and decide, we're going to go after them, and then they went from the most powerful organization to gone. Let me give you a little context. The Crusades were a lost cause by the end of the 1200s, and the Templars were forced out of the Holy Land. Thus, their influence and the support that they received from the European monarchies and other rich folks, right, dedicated to the Crusades and the idea of the Crusades, started drying up. So they were not as rich as they once were by the time 1307 came. But they weren't bankrupt by any means when they were rounded up and disbanded either on October 13th of that year. So it stands to reason that whatever money they did have went somewhere. Where did it all go? Well, the worst kept secret in the story of the persecution of the Templars was that the French king, Philip IV, owed the Templars a lot of money. They helped France fund its wars with England. So while Philip publicly said these arrests were about, you know, sacrilege or that kind of thing, what he really needed to do was expunge his debts. So we can certainly conclude that, as you say, it likely ended up in the coffers of the French king and everyone else who got in on the roundup. And it certainly stands to reason that the French king knew that the influence and the power of the Templars, by the time he was going to do this, was weak enough that he could actually pull it off, where maybe 100 years earlier, it wouldn't have been that easy for the French king to do something like that. But the thing is, with all of this, the Templar theory of Oak Island isn't really about money. One of the ways theorists try to convince us of the theory's plausibility is that the Templars had in their possession the most precious of holy relics in all of Christendom, right? Relics they found, apparently, under the Temple Mount during their time occupying Jerusalem in the Crusades. And it is because of the Templars' fanatic religious devotion and the importance that these relics had to them that they would even consider, no less actually pull off, sailing into the virtual unknown, digging a 100-foot tunnel in an incredibly elaborate and extremely dangerous-to-make booby-trap flood tunnel system. According to the theorists, because of what this stuff was, this gave them the motivation. And it wasn't money that was the motivation. It was religious devotion. The problem with all of this, no one actually has any proof that any such relics were ever recovered or kept in the possession of the Knights Templar. Meaning, if they did actually do that, if they did actually recover the menorah, the Ark of the Covenant, the Holy Grail, whatever you think, they kept it a secret from everyone, including the Pope, who they had their devotion to, for a century or more. You know, it's almost entirely supposition that they had this treasure, and supposition with a large dollop of wishful thinking. And the point I'm trying to make here is that while the Templar theory at its very heart is a plausible one, proving plausibility is not anywhere near good enough, right? Just like we're saying about the Vikings, is it plausible the Vikings and the Templars shared knowledge? Sure, it's plausible. But that does not mean that it happened, you know? We have to prove that first before the theory really has any merit in, you know, giving us a place to dig or whatever it is the theory is showing to us. Anyway, I love it, Steve. What a great, great, great email. Thank you. You really are the best. We're becoming dependent on you guys. I got to tell you. Now, speaking of the Vikings, here is Chad who writes, "Hey, Dave, I recently discovered the podcast and I'm enjoying it. I'm not sure the Viking Norse connection to the Templars can be dismissed entirely. While the Viking Age ended with the conquest of William the Conqueror and the spread of Christianity in Scandinavia, the term Viking meant raider. It was an occupation, not a nationality. And they came from Denmark, Sweden, and Norway. Leif Erikson was a Norseman who had settled in Iceland after his father was banished from Greenland, and the sagas mentioned Vinland for centuries afterwards. Norsemen in the Crusade era absolutely would have at least heard rumors of it and could have passed it to the Templars, Vinland being what they called, what we think they called, Canada. The Varangian Guard was in Constantinople, and the Crusaders usually stopped there on the way to the Holy Land, so there could have easily been conversations about, hey, yeah, we have legends of land to the west, we just stopped going there because we didn't find anything worth the trip. Also, just because there weren't permanent settlements, at least not ones that have been found, doesn't mean the Norse didn't keep exploring the area and didn't find Mahone Bay at some point. Lonsdale Meadows has buildings suggesting that it was at least temporarily inhabited across many different periods based on architectural styles. That's not to say that the Norse absolutely helped the Templars get there and bury the Holy Grail in the Ark, of course. I think it's far more likely to be different. Pirates, privateers burying stuff at different times than any grand conspiracy. Love the show. Looking forward to new episodes. Chad, I think you got it exactly right. Again, is it possible? Yes. It's even somewhat plausible. But as we spelled out last week, there's so many steps we need to climb to get from Norsemen in Constantinople to the Templars on Oak Island, that all it can really be called at this point is an incredibly fun conversation for us to have. All I want to do here is point out the holes in the theories, right? That's my job, because the show makes the viewers think that this is all practically proven. That's where I come in, right? So my job is to kind of plug holes in, and I love, Chad, that you kind of tempering that a little bit, because maybe in this instance it was. We are finding a connection here, but it's a connection that is only just the beginning of a connection. We certainly don't have a proven connection of any time, of any kind, and the connection that we have is really takes a leap of faith, in my mind, at this point. I love it, man. Keep writing in. Let's turn now to our friendly neighborhood environmental engineer. Yes, we have one on this show. His name is Patrick. He writes, "Hi, Dave. There have been previous discussions about what the island looked like in the past when the sea levels were lower. I believe it was Gordon Fader who recommended a sea level change of about 1 foot per 100 years to account for sea level rise and the effects of subsidence. That would mean that the sea level around Oak Island was about 3 feet lower in the early 1700s compared to now. To get a general idea of what Oak Island may have looked like in the early 1700s, I used the existing bathymetry data near the shoreline to map out the approximate shape of the island if the sea levels were 3 feet lower. As shown in the attached picture, it appears that the island was connected to the mainland in early 1700s. And in general, the shoreline around the island would have extended about 100 to 300 feet further out than it does now. That really is an incredible difference if these estimates are true." Now, let me stop here. Patrick did include some fantastic images that spells this all out for you. I think you're going to find them great. Go to Facebook.com, put in Diggin' Oak Island in the search bar, take a look at those. He did an amazing job. Anyway, he continues. "I have also been keeping track of where stone features that look like the old roads, paths, and wharves have been encountered on the island. I'm very curious about how they all are interconnected and what purpose they serve. As shown in the second attachment, there are at least 5 stone features that have been discovered near the swamp and the money pit. 3 look like stone roads or paths discovered while excavating around the edge of the swamp. 1 is an alignment of scattered boulders and cobbles discovered underwater near the shoreline just south of the swamp. And the 5th feature is a pathway of cobbles shown near the money pit in a 1931 aerial photograph. When all these features are shown together on the map, it appears they line up and are interconnected with each other. It also looks like the stones are associated with a wharf that extended out to the low tide line in the early 1700s. Folks, Patrick is doing for us here something incredibly important that for one reason or another, the show has yet to do. Again, check out the Facebook page. He continues, "I believe the swamp used to be a lot smaller before the rise in sea levels and before construction of the roadway around the island that has likely trapped sediments and restricted drainage. In the early 1700s, I imagine that the swamp was more like a small coastal wetland with a spring-fed creek that was considered an ideal location for a small settlement. Assuming those stones are remnants of an old wharf, then I suspect a lot of wood structures they are currently excavating in the swamp are old piles used to support the wharf and nearby roads. I would also guess that the stones were not necessarily the top of either the wharf or the roads leaving the swamp, but the foundation. I would have placed finer aggregates over the stones and compacted the materials down to create a nice flat surface that also drains well to be able to transport goods to and from the wharf. I just can't imagine the final surface of the wharf or the roads being that very bumpy surface of stones we see them now. And there doesn't appear to be any evidence that these stones were previously placed carefully together in interlocking patterns to make a flat surface. I know the show keeps painting the image of ancient Roman or Portuguese roads, but I suspect the construction was a lot simpler than that, and simple solutions are usually the right ones. For me, this doesn't take away from the mystery of the stone features and what they were used for. I would love to find out more, and maybe others can share thoughts. Patrick. Patrick. That was absolutely unbelievable. Again, find me another podcast with listeners this brilliant. Just try, guys. You're not going to find one. It just doesn't exist. The people we have writing here contribute more to the story of Oak Island sometimes than the experts that are on the show. It's incredible. Patrick, I have an interview scheduled with Gordon Fader soon, and it is mostly about this very subject. Gordon's done a lot of work on the sea level stuff, and he wants to sort of discuss it and kind of give it to you guys, the listeners, so you can get a better frame of reference. You know, the information about the sea levels and all this has such an incredible impact on all of these swamp theories, especially that we just need to kind of have this information so we know. And Patrick, you got us off to a great start here. Guys, take a look at these pictures on Facebook. Tell me how this information affects the theories that you're interested in. For one thing, does it change the idea that people would hide something here if this is not an island at the time? It's a great question. Patrick, again, you nailed it here. Keep this in mind as we get to the off season and discuss this topic even more. And as far as your diagram about the stones, again, you did this work the show hasn't done and connected all of this. And it makes sense that all these paths would connect. And to be honest with you, it makes the question more perplexing and more interesting. What is this all? That's what we need to find out. Again, man, thank you so much. Incredible stuff. Okay, that's all for the emails today. Don't forget, if you have any questions or comments, send them along to digginoakisland@gmail.com. All right, it's time now to discuss Season 11, Episode 21 of The Curse of Oak Island, called Straight as an Arrow. Now, folks, this is an incredibly busy time of year for me, and I didn't really have the time to map this all out for us, so I'm going to kind of shoot from the hip a little bit and just work from my notes, so there might be a little bit of rambling in all this. I apologize. Just want to start off with the money pit. Rick and Scott Barlow go and meet with Roger 14 at the Garden Shaft, and they're discussing the water flooding issue. They say the words 479 gallons of water per minute flooding into the shaft. Unbelievable. Later on, there's a video conversation. You know, the other thing about it is Roger, at this point in the beginning, doesn't seem to know how to proceed. Like they're going to have to figure something out here. So the next thing we get on this is a video call in the war room to discuss what the narration calls, quote unquote, mysterious flooding with the guys from Dumas. And the reason why I make a point of the mysterious flooding is, do they really think it's mysterious? Listen, guys, I got a few books you can read. They say that they can pump the water out, but that the size of the pump, the industrial pump, might make the shaft itself unstable. So they really don't want to do that. So they come up with another solution, which is to use a smaller pump to pump out just enough to be able to continue the horizontal drilling. So they're not going to completely dry it out. They're going to kind of take it down a little bit and with this smaller pump be able to continue the probing process. Man, it looks like this garden shaft thing is not going to go the way they wanted it to go. I mean, it just, it's tough, man. Let's just move to a quick trip to Halifax, Nova Scotia. Again, Rick Lagina is with Doug Kroll, and they're meeting with a guy whose name is Eric Wroclawski. Wroclawski, I think is how his name. Eric's father, Paul, worked for many, many years on the island, and he worked with Dan Blankenship, and he found a bunch of stuff as the years went on. And he shows the guys this arrowhead that Paul got from, I believe he said, Robert Dunfield Jr. Doug says that he thinks that it seems that Doug has seen this before and that people have concluded it's possibly from a crossbow. So I guess what we're trying to do here is make this seem medieval and something a knight would have. I don't know. This is very early days on this. The guys take it and they're going to have it examined. So there really isn't a whole lot to add on this one, but just something to keep in mind as we move a little further. Let's go to the swamp. We're going to fly through this because there really was not a lot new here to discuss. And there's a lot of sort of looking ahead to stuff that's going to happen in the future. Marty brings Dr. Spooner to the north end of the swamp. Now, this is where they were looking at boulders last week that were related to the Tree of Life theory that John Edwards was talking about. We discussed that a lot in the last couple of podcasts, so go back and listen. Billy Gerhardt is using a digger to move the boulder, and Spooner says from looking at where the boulder was that he thinks, quote, that possibly the boulder was moved there. I don't know. It's hard to say. Hard for me to say. Spooner finds a piece of wood that he hopes will date when the rock itself was actually put in this location. So again, this is information yet to come. Later on in the episode, they continue digging out, finding timbers and the tree stumps. They find rocks and mud, and I'm not really sure what the guys are saying here about why they think this is man-made. Hopefully I'm wrong, but just from what we're seeing here on these images, it just looks like rocks and mud to me. So Laird and Craig come down to have a look around. They bring Laird Niven in. Funny thing is, Laird doesn't really say much here, right? He's here, but we don't really hear what he has to say, which leads me to believe he didn't really have a lot to say, right? They look at some old wood stakes. We've seen these before in the swamp. They look like property marker stakes to me. And then Spooner comes back again. He takes a look around, and he thinks that everything he's seeing here, which is now some sort of, they're opining, some sort of circular depression, is man-made. Steve Guptill does his magic. The elevation matches with the paved area. Jack Begley and Dr. Spooner say the swamp was, this is one piece in, I put in here that I was really stunned by. Jack Begley and Dr. Ian Spooner say that the swamp was not a swamp pre-1700. They say that twice. Have we ever heard them say that before? Has anyone ever said that before? That the swamp was not a swamp pre-1700s? What are we talking about? What do we mean? What was it? Can we now explain what we're talking about a little bit here? It was such a weird thing to throw in there that we don't really understand what the whole point of it was, right? So it was just so strange. Anyway, Dr. Spooner thinks he could take some samples like he's done in the past and kind of get some dirt here and do some better dating. What I do know is that we've pulled this out, and there's no Ark of the Covenant, like John Edwards said there would be here. So I guess we're moving on to another boulder before the end of the year, or are we just going to go with this one? I have no idea. Again, a lot of this is setup stuff. This is why we're blowing through this episode in just a couple of minutes, because we're going to finish off with conversations here between Rick, Craig, and the team, with Corian Maul and Emilio Zucchetti on a video conference that they're discussing a possible trip to Europe. And they're, again, I guess what they're doing here is they're looking for connections to Nolan's Cross. They're looking for connections to Oak Island or the Vikings. They're talking about the Vikings. And there is a quote here where he writes, where they say, describing how members of the Scandinavian Viking culture who were known to have established settlements in Iceland, Greenland, and northern Canada more than 1,000 years ago, assimilated with the Templar Order during the 12th century Crusades. This is what the narration says they're going to look for. Things that describe how the Scandinavian Viking culture assimilated with the Templar Order during the 12th century Crusades. I have no idea what that meant. I mean, I'm sorry. I have no clue what they're talking about there. There's no proof that anyone assimilated with anything in this relationship here. Anyway, the episode finishes again, this time back in the war room with Corian and Sacchetti. And Corian Maul tells them about some places he wants them to see. Emiliano does the same thing. All of these places look great. I can't wait to see all this. And I love when Corian Maul is involved in all this stuff, because I usually get a text or an email that says something to the effect of, what they didn't show you was this also incredibly amazing thing. So that's great stuff. I absolutely love it. And again, that's it for this episode. We blew through that episode review probably faster than we ever have before, because this really, and it was a decent episode. This isn't a criticism of the episode. And I'm sorry for the rambling. And I'm sorry for not getting the patrons involved in this discussion today. Again, crazy busy time for me this year, this week. Next week will be better. And we're going to have so much time to catch up with the patrons and everything they had to say. But there just wasn't much here. There isn't much to discuss. It was a good episode, and it's an enticing episode, because we know that we're going to get stuff we really like in the not-too-distant future. That's going to do it for this episode of the Diggin' Oak Island podcast. Don't forget, you can really help out the show by becoming a patron. If you think the show is worth $5 a month to you, head over to patreon.com/diggin'oakisland to learn more. And if you prefer, you can also make a one-time donation to the podcast via Venmo. Just use the username @DaveMcBrideMusic. Also, if you'd like to help out the podcast in another way, then you can do so by giving us a 5-star rating, or anywhere you get your podcasts, on iTunes, you know, what do they call it, Apple Podcasts, anywhere. Thanks to everybody who's done that already. Thank you for the kind words. Follow the show on Facebook. Just put in @DigginOakIsland into your search bar. And if you have any questions or comments you want to send directly to me, you can do so via email, digginoakisland@gmail.com. Just remember, if you do send me a message or an email, I'm probably going to read it here on the air. So if you don't want it read aloud, just make a note of that for me. This was a tough one for me to get through today, just because I'm trying to get it all in to get it out to you guys. So it is definitely crown time. Until we speak again, I'm Dave McBride. Thank you for listening to Diggin' Oak Island.